Welcome, this is Marcia for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading National Geographic magazine dated August 2022. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the continuation of the article I began last time entitled Britain's Stone Age Building Boom by Rolf Smith. Parker Pearson, an expert in British prehistory at University College London's Institute of Archaeology, has come to this desolate spot to investigate the possibility, first suggested in a 12th century legend, that the standing stones at Stonehenge may have come from an earlier stone circle in a faraway land. The medieval chronicler and cleric Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote a rollicking tale of how Stonehenge's monoliths were taken from a stone circle in Ireland after a great battle and transported by magic and by boat to where they stand today. While this story is fanciful, there's a chance it may have been based on an old oral tradition that had a kernel of truth to it, says Parker Pearson. For one thing, the stones at Stonehenge actually were transported. Of the hundreds of stone circles in Britain, Stonehenge is the only one whose stones were brought from a great distance. Every other one is made of local stone. It's something that could not have been known in Geoffrey's day. What's more, he points out, this region of Wales was considered Irish territory at the time Geoffrey was writing. Indeed, from this hilltop on a clear day, you can glimpse the Irish coast in the distance. And then there's Wan Mon itself, the remains of one of the earliest stone circles in Britain, dating to around 3300 BC, and located within a few miles of the outcrops where the Stonehenge bluestones are now known to have originated. For some reason, they started building it and abandoned it after they got about a third of the way through, Parker Pearson says, of Wan Mon. We can see where they actually dug holes for additional stones, but never placed them. Of the 15 or so stones that were installed, only one remained standing. Three more are lying in the grass. The rest are missing. Last year, Parker Pearson and his colleagues published a theory that the Stonehenge we know today was built in whole or in part from stones from earlier monuments in Wales that were dismantled and carried east by a migrating community around 3000 BC. One stone in particular, number 62 in the nomenclature of Stonehenge archaeologists, could possibly be traced directly to Wan Mon. The claim, which aired on a British TV special, created a stir in the press and divided archaeologists. Some were skeptical that Wan Mon was a stone circle at all, but merely a few isolated stones. And so Parker Pearson returned to Wan Mon to firm up his theory. The evidence is certainly tantalizing. Stone 62 is one of only three bluestones at Stonehenge made of non-spotted dolerite, the type of stone used to build Wan Mon. However, Stone 62 has a peculiar pentagonal cross-section that appears to match the imprint left by one of the stones that were removed from the ancient Welsh circle. In addition, a stone chip found in the former socket hole suggested that the missing stone was also a non-spotted dolerite. During their follow-up excavation, Parker Pearson and his team were able to build on evidence that Wan Mon was indeed a stone circle and one of strikingly similar dimensions to the early ditch that ringed Stonehenge. And like Stonehenge, Wan Mon appears to have been aligned with the solstice, but they were unable to establish a definitive geochemical match between anything at Wan Mon and the bluestones at Stonehenge, which might have proved their case. But finding an exact match with any one stone was always going to be a long shot. Parker Pearson says, nothing that of the 80-some bluestones archaeologists believe once stood at Stonehenge, only 43 are present today. We have missing stones there and missing stones here, he says, but what we've got now is good evidence that the people who were building the circle at Wan Mon stopped in the middle of making it. They dig a hole for the next stone and then don't fill it. What happened? Where did they go? Where are the stones? Archaeological evidence, or the lack of it, suggests that few people were living at Wan Mon after 3000 BC, a date that dovetails nicely with the idea of a migration from Wales. But an absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, says Parker Pearson. who hopes to return to the Preseli Hills to study ancient pollens that could reveal whether the grazing lands reverted to wilderness around that time. If so, the finding would add weight to his theory that the area was abandoned about the time Stonehenge was built. And if Stonehenge's curiously shaped stone 62 can't be conclusively linked with the stone circle in the Preseli Hills, research by geologists Bevins and Eichser has pinpointed the outcrop from which it came a little to the east of Wan Mon. It's an outcrop that no archaeologist has looked at yet, Bevins says. As geologists, we can't tell the human side of the story, but we can certainly give them a fresh place to pick up the trail. It's about a four-hour drive from Wan Mon to Stonehenge, the last few miles of which are along the A303. This narrow, potholed, notoriously traffic-choked highway passes so close to Stonehenge, the famous monument is almost a roadside attraction. If the intention of the original builders of Stonehenge was to create a landmark that would capture the imagination of generations to come, they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. The global icon is one of Britain's biggest tourist draws, attracting more than 1 million visitors a year before the COVID-19 epidemic. Virtually all of them get here on the A303, which is also a major truck artery and the road taken by millions of vacationers to popular seaside resort towns. In recent decades, the A303 has been upgraded to a four-lane highway for much of its length, but not the few miles either side of Stonehenge. Constant traffic jams mean that it can take locals an hour to drive from one nearby village to another, while endless rumbling trucks detract from the experience of visiting Stonehenge. Everybody agrees that something needs to be done about the A303, says Vince Gaffney, professor of landscape archaeology at the University of Bradford. The question is, what? Stonehenge is the centerpiece of a 20-square-mile UNESCO World Heritage Site, which in turn abuts areas of environmentally sensitive land, a military base and proving ground, and many small communities, so there are few uncontested options for rerouting the highway. A controversial proposal to build a 2-mile-long four-lane tunnel to bypass the Stonehenge site drew fire from archaeologists and sparked protests by a coalition of environmentalists and druids. Last year, Britain's High Court found in favor of the protesters and put the $2.2 billion project on hold. Ironically, the surprise discovery of a mile-wide ring of enormous pits around the nearby henge at Durrington Walls, dug by Neolithic excavators about 4,400 years ago, near the peak of the building boom, played a role in thwarting the 21st century tunnel diggers. The pits were detected in 2015 by a high-tech remote sensing survey of 3,000 acres of the Stonehenge landscape that revealed dozens of unexpected monuments. We noticed these strange anomalies at the time, but were too busy with everything else to follow it up, says Gaffney, who co-led the survey. Later, when we went back, we saw we had these huge pits forming a giant arc around the henge. It was on a scale nobody had ever seen before. It was so huge and unexpected that when the team announced their find in 2020, their claims were met with widespread skepticism, and the house-sized pits were dismissed as naturally occurring sinkholes. Additional research, however, proved the ring of pits had indeed been dug by people toward the end of the great Neolithic building boom, adding yet another layer of mystery to the era. The tunnel proposal has divided archaeologists, with some seeing it as a workable compromise for solving the traffic bottleneck. Sooner or later, something is going to have to be done, says archaeologist Mike Pitts, editor of British Archaeology. The fear is they'll just take the easy way and widen the existing highway to four lanes, and that is something nobody wants. As for the creators of Stonehenge, the Durrington pits, and countless other monuments, one can't help but think they would have loved the tunnel idea, given the havoc they wreaked on their surroundings by their building binge. Britain's ancient forests bore the brunt of it, not only in the thousands of huge oak trees felled to build those enormous palisades, but also in the thousand more needed to erect Stonehenge and other megaliths. People don't realize the vast amount of timber that would have been required, Pitts says. In the case of Stonehenge, transporting dozens of huge sarsen blocks weighing on average 20 tons each, for 15 miles, and then erecting them on site would have required great wooden sledges, an enormous amount of scaffolding, and possibly miles of wooden tracks over which the heavily burdened sledges could be dragged. Contrary to popular myth, the one method they didn't use was rollers. Rollers just don't work, says Pitts, citing evidence from many experiments. They jam up constantly. Whatever the means of transport, movement of the massive stones across the landscape likely attracted crowds of festive onlookers. It would have been like watching the space shuttle go by, Pitts says. As impressive as Stonehenge is, you need to drive another 20 miles to the north, to the Megahenge at Avebury, to grasp the sheer scale and diversity of the building boom. While Stonehenge has global name recognition and those famous Saracen trilithons, Avebury, as the 17th century antiquarian John Aubrey put it, does as much exceed in greatness the so renowned Stonehenge as a cathedral doeth a parish church. The Avebury Henge is almost a mile in circumference, so large that nearly its entire namesake village, including a pub, thatched cottages, and pastures dotted with sheep, fits comfortably in its embrace. The stone circle within it, at more than 1,000 feet in diameter, is the largest in the world. Two more circles lie inside that, and a grand avenue of standing stones leads away from it, stretching a mile and a half across the countryside to an outlying stone and timber circle. And for good measure, the eerie mass of Silbury Hill, composed of 500,000 tons of soil, and the largest human-made mound in prehistoric Europe, is only a 20-minute walk away. Hidden beneath this sleepy patch of bottomland along the River Kennet, just a mile or so downstream from Avebury, lies what Josh Pollard, a professor of archaeology at the University of Southampton, refers to as the sleeping giants of the Avebury landscape. A series of wooden palisades that were built from the trunks of more than 4,000 ancient oaks. During excavations last summer, Pollard and his team discovered yet another timber enclosure, some 300 feet in diameter, and within it, the footings of an enormous rectangular great house, more than 100 feet long, with walls made of gigantic timbers, towering as much as 40 feet above the ground. This would have been a truly astonishing sight, Pollard says. Yet for all Avebury's grandeur and that of the other monuments nearby, it's the River Kennet, flowing through the sleepy Wiltshire countryside a few hundred yards away, that Pollard believes to be the key to understanding the minds of the Neolithic people who built all these things. I think the river was more important to them than the monuments they built along it, he says. You can see it in the creation of Silbury at its source, and in the river's relationship to the palisades. It has a connecting role with the monuments here, just as the River Avon does with the monuments in the Stonehenge landscape. By the dawn of the 25th century BC, the people of Britain surely must have been aware of the momentous technological changes unfolding on the continent with the development of metalworking. In fact, they already may have been using copper tools acquired by trade. It's hard to imagine something like the Avebury Palisades being made without copper tools, says Pollard, adding that any such tools would almost certainly have been reused and recycled many times over during the centuries that followed, making it unlikely that any will be unearthed at Neolithic building sites. What sparked the extraordinary building boom and how and why it came to an end remain unsolved mysteries, but archaeologists note an intriguing connection in time with the rise of the Bronze Age, which arrived in Britain by way of another mass migration from the continent. The dates are awfully close, says English Heritage's Susan Greeny. Was this splurge in monument building a reaction to the changes they knew were coming? Did they sense this was the end of the era? Or could it have been the monument building itself that caused a collapse in the society or its belief system that left a vacuum that others came to fill? Was there some kind of a rebellion against an authority that was ordering all this unsustainable construction? A more chilling possibility is that a pandemic may have played a role. Scientists have found plague bacillus in a Neolithic tomb in Sweden, and earlier this year it was identified in a Bronze Age grave in Somerset. The ancient variety doesn't appear to be as virulent as the one that swept Europe in the 14th century. But there's no telling what its effects might have been on Britain's Neolithic people. It could be that unbeknownst to them, the diaspora who were on the move at the dawn of the Bronze Age were spreading an epidemic, wiping out populations and opening up new areas for people to move into, says the University of York's Jim Leary. One way or another, within a century of Stonehenge's completion, waves of genetically distinct settlers once again were coming over from the continent. History was repeating itself 100 generations later, except this time the newcomers' ancestry stretched back thousands of years to the Eurasian steppes instead of to Anatolia. The so-called Beaker people brought new beliefs, new ideas, their distinctive beaker-shaped pottery, and metallurgical skills that would define the coming age. The Neolithic farmers who built Stonehenge and scores of other monuments faded into history, their DNA all but vanishing from Britain's gene pool. The landscape around Stonehenge would continue to be an important burial site, but the era of mega monuments was over. Monument building is usually a kind of peak of a civilization, Leary says, but I don't think this was the peak of a civilization. I think it was the mad, manic, final throw of the dice of a society that knows its time is up. The next article, India's Energy Challenge, by Utejit Bhattacharjee. Can the nation meet the demands of a booming middle class while curbing carbon emissions? The planet's future might depend on the answer. On a warm and humid morning in the central Indian state of Madhya Pradesh last September, Chetan Singh Solanki stepped off a bus he'd been living in for the past 10 months and walked into a high school auditorium in the small town of Raisen, where 200 students, teachers, and officials had gathered to hear him speak. A solar energy professor at the Indian Institute of Technology, IIT, in Mumbai, Solanki is a slender man in his mid-40s with a boyish appearance and a quick smile that are assets for the mission he's on. In late 2020, he took a leave to make an 11-year road trip around India to inspire action to fight climate change. Solanki's vehicle is a mobile demonstration of the utility of renewable energy. Solar panels generate enough electricity to run the lights, fans, computers, stove, and television on board. After being garlanded and welcomed on the stage, Solanki made an unusual request. I see 15 ceiling fans in this room. It's the middle of the day. There's so much sunlight outside. Yet we have so many lights on in here, he said. Do we really need all of these fans and lights? Let's turn some of them off and see if we'll be okay with it. A couple of students got up to do what he asked. Leave some of them on, though, Solanki joked, when one student got carried away. With half the lights and fans switched off, the auditorium felt warmer and darker. But, Solanki asked, did it really matter all that much? We can see one another just fine, which means there's sufficient light in this room, he said. Is anyone feeling distressed because some fans have been turned off? Thinking, oh God, how am I going to make it? The audience laughed. The point Solanki was making is one of two that he hopes will persuade Indians to achieve what he calls energy swaraj, or energy self-reliance. One idea is to save energy directly by reducing usage and indirectly by consuming less stuff. The other is to generate electricity locally from renewable resources such as the sun, so every town becomes self-sufficient. During the next decade, India's greenhouse gas emissions are projected to increase steeply as the economy expands and the population grows to 1.5 billion, surpassing China's population. Humankind's lust for never-ending economic growth is rapidly changing the planet's climate, he warned. Our arrogance makes us think we can keep increasing consumption without consequence when the world has finite resources. Unless we change our ways, future generations will have to endure great suffering. Solanki grew up in a small village and was the first in his family to get a college degree. At IIT, he founded a Center for Solar Cell Technology, aiming to kickstart a grassroots solar revolution. He started a nonprofit called the Energy Swaraj Foundation, which trains rural women to assemble and sell solar lamps and rooftop panels. 3 years ago, he started thinking about how Mohandas Gandhi, whom Solanki idolizes, might have responded to the climate crisis. That's how he came up with the road trip. He's hoping to spark a mass movement, just as Gandhi did when he led a historic 25-day, 241-mile march during India's freedom struggle against British rule. Solanki's exhortation to live simply may seem surprising in a country with such low per capita consumption. On average, Indians use goods and services worth about $1,000 a year, 1/40th of what Americans do. Yet Solanki's approach could be critical to India's efforts to reduce its contribution to global warming. At the country's current rate of economic growth, the middle class is expected to double by 2030 to 800 million. This will be a welcome milestone for India because it will lift many out of poverty, but it also will mean a tsunami of new consumers who will want spacious homes and air conditioners and appliances and cars, significantly increasing the country's carbon footprint. On August 15, India will celebrate 75 years of independence. The country has made monumental progress during that time, achieving self-sufficiency in food production, creating a space program that launched an orbiter to Mars, supplying vaccines to about 100 countries, and transforming into a technological powerhouse and the sixth largest economy in the world. Now, as an emerging world power, India is stepping up to tackle climate change. With the creation of 45 solar parks, a plan to have 40% of buses, 30% of private cars, and 80% of 2- and 3-wheelers go electric by 2030, and a mission to become a global leader in the production of hydrogen as an alternative to fossil fuels, the country is making strides towards greening its future and the world's. Even so, India faces more daunting challenges than any other country. The rapid expansion of its middle class will drive up energy consumption during the next 2 decades more than anywhere else. To meet the demand, India likely will remain heavily dependent on coal, an abundant resource, for many years while continuing to increase its petroleum imports. The stakes couldn't be higher. The planet's future hinges in many ways on how India navigates the path ahead, balancing its pursuit of strong economic growth with the need to curb emissions. India is the fourth biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, behind China, the United States, and the European Union. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has pledged to reach net zero emissions by 2070, 20 years past the deadline set by the U.S., and 10 years later than China's. India also has promised to reduce its emissions intensity, the volume of emissions per unit of gross domestic product, before the end of the decade, to 45% lower than it was in 2005. The country's total emissions, however, are predicted to keep rising until about 2045. The long horizon to get to net zero and the insistence on using emissions intensity rather than emissions to track progress disappointed some environmental activists, but Indian officials say the country is doing more than its fair share within the constraints of a developing nation. Until about 15 years ago, India's stance, still common among developing countries, was that climate change needed to be tackled by industrialized nations, such as the U.S., because they had been pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere long before India had much of a carbon footprint. The disparity in the share of responsibility for the problem is hard to miss. All one needs to do is compare lifestyles in the West, where personal car ownership, air-conditioned homes, and other energy-intensive comforts are the norm, with the way that most Indians live even today in a state of extreme austerity. As the changing climate sparked increasing alarm in the mid-2000s, India became more willing to search for solutions. There was a growing feeling that we need to go beyond ascribing blame, says R.R. Rashmi, a former bureaucrat who represented India in climate negotiations for many years and is now a fellow at the Energy and Resources Institute, TERI, in New Delhi. It's a global problem. Everybody must share the burden. India has plenty of reasons to be worried. The country's 4,670-mile coastline is under threat from sea level rise, especially the low-lying eastern coast, which could be calamitous for tens of millions of people. This spring, after the hottest March on record, an extended heat wave sent temperatures soaring above 100 degrees across much of the country, withering crops in the field. Droughts also are becoming more severe. Cyclones are lashing the coast with increasing fury, flooding urban areas. A deep depression may take the form of a cyclonic storm. A cyclonic storm may become severe cyclonic storm, and a severe one may turn into a very severe cyclonic storm, says Suruchi Badwal, a researcher at Terry. So the nature of the events is changing. India's vulnerability to climate change is a prime motivation for the country's policymakers to act, but concerned over India's energy security, the country will spend $100 billion this year on oil imports, is another driver. India is really starting well, says Nicholas Herna, a researcher at the New Climate Institute in Germany, citing in particular the expansion of renewable energy and the development of transportation systems that don't rely on fossil fuels. But he points out that not all of India's steps are in the right direction. The country relies on 285 coal-fired plants and plans to build 48 more by the end of the decade. To try to understand India's dependence on coal, I visited Jharia in the coal-rich eastern state of Jharkhand, standing on the edge of a 30-foot deep pit the size of a few football fields. I watched workers load explosives into holes drilled in a far corner. Somebody handed me a hard hat, and a supervisor ordered the charges detonated. The sound echoed across the coal mine. Rocks flew high in the air. A dust cloud billowed over the site of the explosion. This quarry is new. Miners will blast out several more feet of earth to get to the coal seam. India is opening more mines like this one to meet its growing needs. The choice to continue burning coal instead of switching to cleaner fuels is driven by a simple fact. India has enormous coal reserves, nearly a tenth of the world's total. And yet, its production capacity of about 850 million tons a year isn't enough. The country imports about 200 million tons annually. After the blast, I walked over to a corrugated metal shed where workers congregate and talked with Ram Madhav Bhattacharji, a professor of mining at the India Institute of Technology in nearby Dhanbad, with years of experience in the industry. A soft-spoken man who had helped organize my visit, Bhattacharji, is a member of government panel studying the future of coal in India. According to the panel's projections, the country's demand for coal is expected to reach about 1.4 billion tons by 2035. We cannot afford to not increase our production, Bhattacharji told me. Once we get to 1.4 billion tons, we may plateau for 5 to 10 years and then start declining, but that'll be by 2050 or so. This concludes readings from National Geographic magazine for today. Your reader has been Marcia. If you've enjoyed hearing this content, please give us a call at 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening and have a great day.